When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Today's episode is brought to you by our listeners and supporters over on our Buy Me a Coffee page. Thank you all for the support by giving our show a listen, leaving a review or comment, following us on our Twitter, or sharing our show with your friends and family. If you want to support the show further, check out our BMAC page for more information. Link will be in the description. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you all so much for the love and support. And now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to Into the Night, a Finance Phrase podcast. I am your host, Nick, and thank you for listening. In our last episode, we discussed the overall story of Ultimate Custom Night, or UCN for short, as a continuation of the story of Freddy Fazbear's Pizzeria Simulator, or FNAF 6. As we get a metaphorical view of William Afton being tortured, whether it be hell, purgatory, or being trapped in his own mind, as he dies by the hand of his victims and his murderous machinations, only to be reborn again in the same place to die again over and over and over again by the hands of Golden Freddy. If I'm to be perfectly honest, I really did wish this was the end of William Afton's story, as there's no better endpoint than this current hell for him. I think at least it's the perfect purgatory for William, his narcissistic moniker of "I always come back," perverted in this new world where he will experience and feel the anguish of dying relentlessly, but never obtain the sweet release of death's finality. He may never truly die, but he will never truly come back again, neither. That's the thing about Scott Cawthon's writing that, I'll be frank, I kind of miss in the post-Scott era of FNAF games, how he was always able to cleverly call back to his previous attributes of the story, despite how limited scope FNAF had. He was always able to create Easter eggs like this that resonate with you on an emotional level. Scott has a clever way of utilizing his past work in a way that echoes the previous entries on a thematic level, which always gives them a sense of validity. His subsequent games are not trying to run off and do their own thing in this world, no, they are unnaturally part of it. After all, wouldn't FNAF feel off now without William Afton instead of the purple guy? Wouldn't it feel strange if every night guard was a random 9-to-5 worker instead of Michael? All the tiny little reflections and echoes of what happened before and what is to come help solidify the story and mystify the supernatural elements. For how ironic is it that the game that chronologically starts the franchise, a story of a nightmare which a young boy can escape from and dies over and over and over again, only for that same nightmare to repeat. How ironic is it that Scott's final chapter in that story is an epilogue in which the man who has created all the chaos and misery must also experience that same pain, of dying over and over in a living nightmare he can't escape from. It's like poetry. It rhymes. The beginning reflects the end, and each stanza in between rhymes with the previous ones, creating a consistent melodic flow to the story. Today's episode isn't going to be about that, unfortunately. FNAF, at its core, is also a story of mysteries, and UCN is no different in that regard. Some of its mysteries do venture into that experimentation category. So let's finish up our tour and see what other truths can be found in the dark hallways with no exits. This is episode 13, The One You Shouldn't Have Killed.
Now I will tell you a story about a young boy who lived on a farm. The boy lived with his older brother on the outskirts of town, where they raised chickens in a small hen house. One day, a fox crept in and stole a chicken. The boys thought nothing of it and simply placed a new lock on the door. The next day, the fox somehow got inside again and ate 5 chickens in the hen house. The boy, not wanting to see his flock be massacred, decided on laying a trap for the fox. The next night, he left the hen house door wide open and placed a bear trap near the door. The boy smiled widely when he heard the sound of jagged metal go off in the middle of the night, and ran down from his room filled with pride that he was able to make the animal who had taken the lives of his birds. But his smile faded and his face went blank when he saw a trail of blood leaving the hen house. It was raining that night, and the water would soon wash away the trail, so the boy decided to follow. As the boy followed the trail, listening to the sounds of thunder crackling in the sky, he began to contemplate what he was going to do when he found the fox. He considered locking him in a cage, but he realized the fox was too slippery and could escape. He considered taking him somewhere else in the woods, but then he would just be tossing the problematic animal to another. He even considered ripping out the fox's teeth to make sure he couldn't hurt another innocent bird again. However, it turned out that none of those methods would be necessary, as when the boy approached the end of the trail of blood, another explosion of thunder echoed in the sky, and the boy's brother walked out of the fox's cave carrying his corpse by the tail. A trail of blood leaked from his legs and a small bullet hole could be seen on his forehead. The boy had mistaken the last bit of thunder for the sound of his brother's revolvers. The older of the two said, "You were only taking a half measure to the problem, a partial solution. But when dealing with life and death, there can be no half measures."
In between your various nights during UCN, your game may momentarily pause for an intermission break. I briefly mentioned these intermission breaks in our previous episode, as it is a reference to the overall arcade aesthetic that UCN utilizes. After every 700 congruent points earned, nets you a cutscene from 2 different, and I mean wildly different, stories. Now, I want to preface, I don't know why Scott chose these stories or why he wanted to use these particular art directions for these stories. Additionally, these stories are the pinnacle of possible red herrings. I admit, there's no fully clear way of looking into these stories, no clear one-to-one with any aspect of the lore to get a clear indication of what they are supposed to mean, or if they are to mean anything at all and are just short stories that are meant for fun and laughs. The stories are indeed ridiculous and over the top, even in FNAF standards, if you can believe it. Because of this, I think it's important to adhere to the advice of the wise words of the scholar and philosopher, Mr. Hippo.
Not every story has to have significance, you know. Sometimes a story is just a story. If you try to read into every little thing and find meaning in everything anyone says, you'll just drive yourself crazy. I had a friend do it once. Wasn't pretty. We talked about it for years. And not only that, but you'll likely end up believing something you shouldn't believe and thinking something you shouldn't think or assuming something you shouldn't assume, you know? Sometimes, I said, a story is just a story. So just be quiet for one second of your life and eat your sandwich, okay?
So, please keep in mind that we are entering very speculative territory this episode. And what I'm about to say are my interpretations of the two UC and intermission storylines. With that said, let's begin. Vengeance is the first story intermission of UCN and follows a rather simple, if not strange, plot. The intermission plays as a cheesy Japanese samurai movie, starring Freddy Fazbear as the White Samurai trying to dispense justice, while Foxy the Pirate plays the villain with Mangle as his sidekick. The show is even voiced in Indian Japanese, with English subtitles provided for translation. Freddy, referred to as simply the Bear, has been in a constant battle with the Fox, Foxy the Pirate, and attempting to make right and obtain vengeance against the Fox for embarrassing him in their previous conflicts. Every week he plans to raid the Fox's dojo, but the Fox is too cunning and clever and will always know what the Bear is planning. Not saying that the Bear's plans are a work of strategic genius in the first place, in fact most are naive in principle. He starts out fair enough, attacking him at night and on his birthday, but after those plans fail, it slowly dawns how futile the Bear's efforts are, as every single plan becomes worse than the last. These plans include playing a flute to cause him to go to sleep, placing a dead fish in his pockets, and coming down the chimney as Santa Claus. Each time the Bear tries, it always fails, for the Fox always has a trap laid out. After every defeat, however, the Fox does not kill the Bear, but instead gives him a form of punishment, such as doing his laundry, cooking his breakfast, or hanging up his Christmas decorations. Why are there so many Christmas references? After several weeks have gone by, the Fox grows weary of the conflict and instead chooses to go on vacation to relieve himself of the mundanity of it all. Leaves the Mangle to take care of the house and feed the dog, only to remember that the Mangle is the dog. The Bear, however, does not give up hope after his adversary has left, for while all his attempts may have been failures, and the Fox leaving the valley could be seen as victory, he understands that his destiny is to find and destroy the Fox once and for all. He will hunt down the Fox wherever he may crawl and hide to. Just right after he finishes a bowl of hot noodle soup. The end. So that was a doozy, huh? Okay, here we go. So what did any of that mean? Especially considering that it was probably one of the most ridiculous things ever to occur in this franchise. Then again, isn't that part of the charm of FNAF? That it's a horror series that isn't afraid to laugh at itself? Comedy and horror really are closer than one usually realizes, and I won't deny, this story is funny. It's full of Scott's wacky humor. But is there anything about this that we can apply to FNAF's story overall? Any lore to gather out of this? Or is this just a story for the sake of being a story? Personally, I believe the latter. In fact, to go on record, I believe that neither of these cutscene stories, these intermission stories, have anything to do with FNAF's overall story. But I do want to play devil's advocate here. So let's say that we knew for a fact that this story did have hidden meaning behind it. What would it be? This is a stretch. The closest story I could come up with is Bear Vengeance being a metaphor, a visual metaphor, for Golden Freddy trying to capture William Afton. Now, why Golden Freddy in particular? Why not Henry or Michael? Well, simply because the usual symbolic uses of the characters don't work in the story. For those of you who don't know, most members of the Afton family have a Fazbear character associated with them. A quick rundown. William, of course, has Bonnie, and Elizabeth Afton has Circus Baby. But equally so, Michael is associated heavily with Foxy, and his younger brother, the crying child, is associated heavily with Fredbear and Golden Freddy. With these being common signifiers and links for these characters, shouldn't Michael be Foxy in this scenario? Well, no. Because, as we have gone over multiple times in this story, Michael isn't a villain or a bad guy. He may view himself as such at the death of his younger brother, but his actions afterwards speak of a braver man trying to atone for his past sins. Now, could Samurai Freddy be representing his younger brother, and Foxy being portrayed as Michael as a bad guy be a symbolic flashback to when he used to torment his brother at the Afton household? Michael is in the story, after all, and we do know Elizabeth had a fun-time Foxy plush toy that was pulled apart in her room as a scene in FNAF 4 akin to the Mangle's origin. Perhaps the story is a metaphor for the early years of the Afton household. I don't think so. For one, two characters who have heavy association with Fazbear mascots are now suddenly changing their intended character links for one story seems like a stretch. And not to mention, if this was the case, why is Mike the one outlier who still uses his original character, especially in a way that doesn't betray him in a way that we are familiar with? More so, why would we need to betray him like this in the first place? We know Michael was a bully who acted out of line in FNAF 4. His father's abuse and neglect were being negative influences that were turning Michael into a miniature version of his father. And the disappearance of his little sister and the apparent lack of a mother figure is causing him to act out much more sadistically than he should ever have. If we were to go back and look into how he behaved, one would think we would get a much more in-depth look at the Afton family household as a whole. Not just this supposed brother rivalry between Mike and his younger brother that was never previously established. Not even Henry truly makes sense as a representation of the samurai, Freddy. While there exist many characters like the puppet or Michael who hunt down William Afton, Henry was one who was introduced late into the franchise. He's part of the beginning and only reappears at the end. Trying to hint that he was always hunting down William in the background is a very strange way to explain away where Henry was in the 40 years after Fredbear shut down. And what I think Scott would want to be more direct than an explanation for it, at the very least more direct than this. If this story is an interpretation of someone hunting down William, Golden Freddy is the most likely answer. Simply being that early on, Michael was concerned more about freeing the souls of the MCI victims, and the puppet had its own hands full before that as well. Golden Freddy, as a phantom-esque entity, had more free will and power to take action than the other victims of William Afton. The story would also give precedence over Henry's monologue in the HRY-223 file in FPS during the Insanity ending. Henry claims that William was able to lure and trick his victims again, in reference to him tearing the vessels of the original Fazbear band as seen in FNAF 3's minigames. Seeing a story in which Golden Freddy is always trying to get William, but he always has a countermeasure in place to make sure that his victims, even after coming back to life, can't touch him, is very in character. While shown only quickly in FNAF 3, William is shown to know what caused the spirits of his victims to tick. In The Silver Eyes, the first novel in the non-canon novel trilogy, William explains to Charlie and her friends why they're in danger while locked in the abandoned Freddy Fazbear's Pizza, while he is safe. When one of Charlie's friends, John, questions why he thinks he is safe when he too is trapped inside with him, William responds with, quote, "When it gets dark, they will awaken. Children's spirits will rise. They will kill you. I'll just walk out in the morning, stepping over your corpses, one by one. They don't remember. They've forgotten. The dead do forget. All they know is that you are here with them, trying to take away their happiest day. You are intruders. You are grown-ups. End quote. That last part of the quote is in reference to how he knows the children will no longer be able to accurately perceive him while he's in his spring bonnie suit. Because when he wears it, he is, quote, one of them, end quote. The bear's vouch to follow the fox wherever he goes could be a subtle way of signifying how Golden Freddy won't find peace even after William Afton is gone. He will continue to hunt and fight him, continue to try and try again until William Afton suffers for his crimes, no matter how many times he slips through his fingers or humiliates him when he fails. But, like I said, this story is one of those that seem to be more for the sake of comedy rather than symbolic storytelling. After all, the leaps of logic one has to make to reach a conclusion are quite large. And the addition of the mango being part of the story has really no easy answer. Like I said, this could just be a case of the story being, well, just a story. Anyway, that's one weird anime show done. Surely the second one won't be as weird.
Diary. Yesterday was so amazing, and I met such a wonderful guy. But I don't think it was meant to last, for my heart belongs to another. He's so amazing and strong and so, so cute. I've been thinking about him all day, and I think he's really into me too. He's the only one for me. I just know it. And I know just how to get him. Look at that top hat. That amazing top hat. He'll be mine by the end of the day. I just know it. I told him that I needed help with my homework. But once he's there, I'll have him. And once I have him, he'll be mine forever. There is only one thing that could possibly go wrong.
Why am I here? Just to suffer? Is this truly what I'm destined to do in life? To talk about the magic of FNAF, to remark about its amazing storytelling, its symbolism, its comprehension, but then to be thrown this... anime weeaboo nonsense. What is it meant to do when Michelangelo paints the ceiling of Sistine's chapel only for a god to laugh in his face?
So the second intermission storyline, strangely enough, is another parody of the anime genre. Once again, don't know why Scott chose to do this. This time a riff on the high school romance drama, with a little bit of poking fun at the yandere trope often found in said genre called Toy Chica, the High School Years. The plot is pretty straightforward, just like the last one. Over the course of the intermissions, Toy Chica starts each day at high school with a new crush after the previous one didn't work out. Her methods of trying to win over her sudden new crush become more extreme after every episode, with less and less appealing reasons for her to go after her newfound love interest. Oh, and it is heavily implied that each crush is murdered in some fashion, because Toy Chica is playing into the yandere trope. For those who don't know what a yandere is from, and I can't believe I'm about to cite this on my show, but from the Dairy Types fandom's wiki, quote, yandere is a Japanese archetype used to define a character whose love, adoration, and devotion is so strong that it is expressed as an excessive obsession and possessiveness. They are often seen as characters that are crazy in love with someone. They become so attached to their love interest so that it's impossible to let go. They probe the deepest recesses of their love interest heart so as to more perfectly form their greatest self within their love interest. Some will go as far as to behave in immortal and troubling ways. They will not care about the negative effects that their behaviors can have to others, including their love interests, because they only care about their own feelings. End quote. And that is, in effect, the storyline of Toichika the high school years. Each episode she finds a new love, only to kill them the next day. I will say, though, it is hilarious how she justifies each of her schemes to get her victims to fall in love with her. My personal favorite's being setting her crush's house on fire so they come running into her arms, or, and this is all true, put a bag over their head, hit them with a shovel, okay, and lie that she was trying to protect them because, and I swear to God this is true, she tells them that Balloon Boy put a hit out on them. Didn't know Balloon Boy was a mafioso. The final intermission episode ends with Toichika sitting against a tree in the park, concluding in her diary that her quest was for naught, as she was left with nothing but a broken heart. As her backpack lays open, revealing trophies of her past lovers, including the Marionette's mask, Foxy's hook, and Frey's top hat, she states that tomorrow is another day, and she will not give up. Once again, I will reiterate that I believe that none of these stories have any relevance to the plot and are just there for Scott to troll his fanbase as he often loves to do. But I, once again, am going to play devil's advocate here and enter back to Theory World for this. So, like the previous intermission stories, if we pretend we know for a fact that this story had a deeper underlying meaning, what could it possibly be? Well, on the previous one, the interpretation here seems pretty obvious, if there is one. This story has the possibility of giving a bit more context to William Afton's murders in the MCI, specifically how he was able to do it without getting caught. The biggest clue to this isn't the fact that Toichika clearly kills innocents and keeps trophies, but rather how Toichika explains how she's going to lure and lie her victims into her embrace. One of her methods is even beat for beat one of the most infamous scenarios William used for killing one of his victims, that being the infamous dead dog story for Susie. As previously established in FFPS in the Furry Maze game, which was previously discussed in episode 11, Now Let Me Tell You a Story, the method of William Afton using the grief that young Susie, who later go on to possess Chica, felt after the death of her dog to lure her away by claiming that he never died, and that he could show her dog is alive and perfectly fine. It's one of the darkest parts of the franchise, and to practically use an example of William's deplorable acts of manipulating his victims in the games, novels, and even the novella series. And it is also reused line for line in Toichika the High School Years.
I told him that someone ran over his dog in front of my house. But once he's there, I'll entice him with warm cookies, lure him inside, invite him inside, and then I'll have him. And once I have him, he'll be mine forever.
I will say that it's a strange way to display William Afton's behavior killing children in a similar way that a psychotic yandere in an anime kills her multiple beloveds. But perhaps a metaphor is supposed to be looked at in an emotional level in terms of love. No. William already had love. We know he had a wife. And we know he had three children. But rejected, neglected, and abused that love consistently. His heart was already empty. But perhaps that is the point. That William Afton's inability to find pleasure or satisfaction in common love, and instead looked into destruction and debauchery as an avenue to feel happiness in his murder. His first kill being his best friend's daughter, giving him a rush of adrenaline and euphoria. He continued to chase it, only to find it less satisfying than before. So he takes another life, then another, another. Stalking, spying, and learning about his victims and their weaknesses, and best ways to manipulate them. And always ready to have someone there to potentially take the fall for him. But never able to fully find that same level of euphoric release that he felt when his hands first dripped the blood of adolescent innocence. Or perhaps a story is just a story, and this means absolutely nothing. Like I said before, there isn't really anything obvious to conclude from the stories, and it could literally be a troll from Scott knowing the fans would go in to dig every detail of his game, so he had them dig into every nook and cranny in a cheesy parody anime show. Personally, I wouldn't put it behind him. This is the same man who supposedly gets hacked after every new game release, only for that hack to be a gigantic elaborate troll designed by him. That includes Ultimate Custom Night. Funny enough, that Ultimate Custom Night troll game has my favorite meta line in the entire realm of FNAF's content. That being Freddy literally screaming at Chica, "You have lore relevance." Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I'll be honest, I am left unsatisfied. After going through all this, not that I don't enjoy going down the rabbit hole with FNAF, but when it is unclear if it all matters, and it really doesn't in this case, at least I believe so. I mean, even if any one of my interpretations or theories wound up being accurate, does it really matter all that much? It doesn't quite enhance the story or lore in a meaningful way, as it's not required information to know in a lore aspect. It doesn't have an emotional resonance in the narrative one. So before we end off this episode and leave UCN behind, I want to do something fun. Is it during theory territory? Absolutely. Major theory territory. But it will be fun. Let's discuss the most infamous mystery in the franchise. I mentioned a couple times previously. Let's give it a fair rundown. Let's discuss the identity of Golden Freddy.
Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Golden Freddy, one of the biggest mysteries in the franchise. Who is the creature behind the golden mask, capable of warping in and out of reality, cause hallucinations wherever he appears, and has the power to trap William Afton in his subconscious to experience tremendous agony and pain? This character has been a mystery ever since the first game, and by the second, it was riled with even more mystery. And after almost 8 years, there are so many contradictions and different points and threads and weaves that this character has gone under that it's almost impossible to figure out what he's supposed to be or even represent. Honest question here to everyone, okay? I want you to honestly think about this. Is Golden Freddy an MCI victim? Now, I would assume most of you would say yes. And, alright, let's go with yes. Now, second question. If he is just simply an MCI victim, why is he slash she as powerful as they are? If they are no different than the other four characters who share the same fate as them, why are they that powerful? You don't know that answer, do you? Because even in the second game, when the puppet is shown giving the MCI victims a new vest to live on by giving gifts and giving life, Golden Freddy is unique in that he appears as a split second before the game over, and he jump scares the player. Signifying that he was unique in the regard that he didn't need the puppet to carry him into his arms. This is actually echoed in FFPS, something I think a lot of people miss. When Henry says those exact same words when addressing his daughter for the final time, the Give Gifts minigame shows up for FNAF 2 on the monitor. But Golden Freddy is absent. Now, it isn't like it's unique that characters have been able to come back to life without supernatural support before. Charlie and William Afton, for example, live on by the vessel they were most attached to and died in very close proximity of. Michael, in the most jarring and powerful example, lived on his own corpse with the help of the scooper injecting his body with large amounts of remnant, giving him the strength to repossess his own corpse. So, why can't Golden Freddy be like that? Whoever died was in close proximity to Fredbear and possessed the suit and was a very powerful soul. Alright, let's work with that. Now here's a follow-up question for you then. How would that child have a strong connection with Fredbear? After all, we know the MCI took place in 1985. Fredbear and Spring Bonnie were banned in 1983 and hidden from the public. Why and how would a child have a strong connection to a mascot they probably never heard of? You don't have an answer for that one as well, I assume. But I bet you thought of one. It brings us to our first potential most popular suspect to the identity of Golden Freddy. Cassidy. Cassidy, according to this theory, was the fifth victim of the MCI, a brunette girl who died by the hands of William and ended up possessing and taking the form of Golden Freddy. This theory began to take root with the release of a book called The Survival Logbook, an interesting activity book that you could buy that was not only supposed to be an in-universe logbook used by Fazbear security guards, but the first page of this book reveals the owner of this specific logbook is none other than Michael Afton himself. The logbook has some great value in getting into both the Fazbear Entertainment Corp persona, as well as insight into Michael Afton's head. This book really did showcase that Michael was basically a grown-up kid. An adult who was robbed of his childhood and still hasn't grown up enough some of his childish habits. It's complete with a dark sense of humor and a penchant for drawing comics and sketches. Side note, this book actually gave Mike and his father another parallel. While William himself admits he has a tenacity for the performing arts, Mike seems to have a knack for the visual arts. Fascinating. And I think that's what the logbook was mainly intended for, in my personal opinion. It seemed to be a fun experiment in both getting into Michael's headspace as well as outright confirming his identity in the franchise. A quick reminder in terms of timeline. When the Survival Logbook came out, there was still a minority portion who did not believe Michael was both the Night Guard or the older brother wearing the Foxy Mask in FNAF 4. This book reaffirms his identity into non-debatable in a variety of ways. For one, it outright confirms that Mike is a security guard on the very first page. So, that's non-negotiable. But whenever this book references security, specifically Fazbear Entertainment security, it uses a mascot to represent your local Freddy Fazbear Night Guard. In this case, every single time they show an image of Fazbear Entertainment security, the mascot they always use is Foxy the Pirate. Remember how I told you that every member of the Afton family had a connection in some form to Fazbear characters? This book tries again and again and again to symbolize that Michael, the Night Guards, and the older brother are all the same character. The most blatant attempt at this being a cartoon where Foxy, wearing a security badge and tie, is reading a magazine called Screws, Bolts, Hairpins. The very same magazine Handy mentions at Sister Location, which was Michael's first introduction into the series.
Welcome to the first day of your exciting new career. Whether you were approached at a job fair, read our ad in Screws, Bolts, and Hairpins, or if this is the result of a dare, we welcome you.
But there also exists faded text within the book. Text that was originally not meant to be in the book and looked faded in from age, despite the book being, generally speaking, new. In this text, there are hints of another entity trying to get into communication with Michael, or perhaps someone else. As not only does there exist Mike's own notes in the form of red ink, but there also exists text that was clearly supposed to be printed on that somehow was altered. Given the state of FNAF 1, and how often the buildings have changed, shifting your perception of where things are and were on walls to even where it was in front of Michael's face, this could all be explained away by a supernatural degradation, if you'd like. So, where does the name Cassidy come from? Well, believe it or not, the Foxy Grid word search activity. Yeah, bear with me here. So in the book, there exist tally marks, and when you use these tally marks in conjunction with the faded text, you get certain numbers passed off, page numbers they were on. Now you bring this information to Fox Grid to make a decipher code. Using this decipher code in the word search minigame, our previous page, one can now cover the hidden name of Cassidy. But, except, no you don't. But to use that same code, but utilize the magazine numbers that I mentioned beforehand, with Foxy, when he had the magazine, and you add 8 to it, it shifts the names around, and suddenly you get Evan, a popular fan name for Bite Victim. So Bite Victim's name is Evan after, right? Well, no, because if you ignore all that, you don't do any reverse engineering, and instead you use the Foxy on the Foxy grid as a base for same code, and you paste it with it. And a code shifts again. Or here's a crazy idea. Now this works, and we are trying to really, really hard to make something out of this. The Foxy Grid will probably be the funniest moment in FNAF fandom history to me, because of the absolute insanity of trying to solve a puzzle that no one could really tell for sure was even supposed to be there. Evident on how there are so many methods to finding answers, each one with their own way that was really hard to scrutinize when compared to each other. Were they all extreme long shots? Well, yeah, but when everything's a long shot, how can you tell which one's the most accurate? Is it the information it presents? Is it the code solving? How much of the book it uses? How many sources of the book is it using? It's a mess. Now, why would Cassidy even be a name used by so many people, and why do they associate it with Golden Freddy? Well, and get ready for this. It's because in the Fourth Closet, the finale of the novel trilogy, one of William's victims of the MCI was named Cassidy. Was this the victim that possessed Golden Freddy in the book continuity? No, because it was revealed, surprisingly early on in Silver Eyes, that a kid named Mike Brooks, no association with Michael Apton, a childhood friend of Charlie, was Golden Freddy. Regardless of solution. You have to ask yourself this, and this is my final question to you. Is it narratively satisfying to have William Apton suffer at the hands of a victim we have never heard about? Not Golden Freddy. I'm not talking about Golden Freddy. I'm talking about Cassidy, a character we had to conclude to be a random NCI victim, with no other association to him than any other MCI victim had, and one we are practically introduced to in UCN, and one whose identity we had to conclude from an outside source of a logbook that we had to use a code method to solve. Is it satisfying narratively that a random victim had this much power, caused this much pain to William, and inadvertently leads the events to future games? If you ask me, No, it isn't satisfying. This is the classic case of trying to solve an answer by jamming puzzle pieces in, rather than looking at the whole picture, see whether or not the piece you're trying so desperately to make work could even fit there in the first place. And the funniest part? We know it doesn't work from UCN. Remember? They addressed the one you should not have killed as a male.
He's here and always watching, the one you shouldn't have killed.
I have seen him, the one you shouldn't have killed.
And before you say that they're addressing the character of Golden Freddy, aka Fredbear, as he is the male character, no. These are the spirits talking, as seen with the Marionette, who was a male mascot character possessed by a little girl. She's referred to by female pronouns when characters who know who she is talk about her. Male pronouns only come from gameplay instructions and Fazbear Entertainment employees and management who don't know about the spirits and ghosts of Fazbear Entertainment's past. That's what makes Cassidy so hilarious, in my opinion. It's a theory that has so many hoops of logics you have to weave your way around through to get there. And yet it's probably the most popular theory surrounding Golden Freddy. I'll gladly eat my words if I find out I'm wrong. If I am ever truly discovered I am wrong. Honest admission with all of you. I despise Golden Freddy. I do not like him at all. Golden Freddy, in my opinion, is a mystery that should have been answered directly 6 years ago in FNAF 4, Sister Location, or FFPS. The fact that it was never answered, in my opinion, was a problem of Scott's unwillingness to write something the fandom may not like. And you know what? I can understand that. I really do. I truly can. Mystery has lingered for so long, and has been told over and over again how important it is. The truth be told, it's been so long I don't care anymore. I do not care who Golden Freddy is. It could be janitor for Freddy's for all I care. It could be phone guy, sure, why not? I don't care because it's become such an inconsequential mystery up there with the Bite of 87. Because truly, what does it matter who Golden Freddy is if he does so little in the overall plot? You could say that makes me a bit of a hypocrite. Especially when I asked you if it was narratively satisfying if Golden Freddy is some random character who's the almighty torturer of William. Truth be told, wouldn't any answer by that point be completely satisfying in the long run? Well, I told you I wanted this to be fun. So I'm going to try to make it satisfying with my own theory. This is my interpretation and what I believe to be true about the identity of Golden Freddy.
Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Recall the 8-bit minigames from FNAF 3, ones where every night a new animatronic was led to the back room and systematically were tricked and taken apart by William Afton. After they were all dismembered, a lone spirit popped up, walked towards the back rooms towards William. With all the other spirits present, blocking William in, it is clear the ghost we play as Golden Freddy. Golden Freddy then spooks William to his core, for the first time the franchise's monster shaken, visibly afraid, scared for his life. He then dons his spring bonnet suit, laughing at his victims for being so easily fooled. Until the spring lock snaps shut, William, who had been so elusive to turn to escape death, had met his end in the suit he used to cause so much of it. Only when he was bleeding out and dying in a perfect state of suffering, only then with his spirits, and Golden Freddy is satisfied. This scene shows us the core of Golden Freddy's character. Golden Freddy's character is one that believes unjust acts should be punished, and those who cause his friends to suffer must pay the price. Like Charlie, he is full of sympathy for the weakest, the unfortunate, the forgotten. He lives in a world where the weakest are crushed and slaughtered, including himself. And when those who destroy or humiliate the weak must be punished, Golden Freddy will be the one willing to sentence those monsters to death.
Hey, do me a favor. Maybe sometime you could check inside those suits in the back room. I'm going to try to hold out until someone checks. Maybe it won't be so bad. Yeah, I always wondered what was in all those empty heads back there. You know... Oh, no.
To me, this mysterious yellow bear has always fit the preconception of what a ghost or supernatural entity is like. He can teleport and go through walls, can seemingly cause on-the-spot hallucinations and warp the world around us, and can turn himself invisible along with changing his form. It's quite possible that, with the exception of FNAF's more mythological characters, like Nightmare / Nightmare Yawn and Old Man Consequences, he is the most powerful human spirit in the franchise. Now, for Michael, the use of Golden Freddy has always been to symbolize his guilt. Michael never forgave himself for killing his younger brother, despite it being an accident. Quickly going back to the logbook, in response to the question of do you have dream in the faded text of the survival logbook, he drew Nightmare Fredbear in response. For Michael, Golden Freddy is his literal ghost. He's a symbol for the sin he holds himself responsible for, taking form of the very machine that broke his brother's skull on a prank gone wrong, and changing the colors of his attire from purple to black as a symbolic gesture of death now being attached to him, as the entity's mouth always hangs agape whenever he sees it. Yes, I believe that Golden Freddy is none other than the crying child. The bite victim from Finance Phase 4, the youngest Afton, and Michael's younger brother. Like I said before, almost anyone who comes back to life in a vessel has a connection to it. And who has a stronger connection to Fredbear than the crying child in FNAF's story? The child who saw that bear as an imaginary friend who guided him even after death. This actually explains Golden Freddy's behavior as the story goes on. As in FNAF 2, he is like the other children, frightened and scared, and only attacks Mike after William commits another murder spree. This actually could be because he thinks he is William. After all, Elizabeth possibly made the same errands to the location, mistaking Michael for William, as Mike and William look quite identical.
They didn't recognize me at first, but then they thought I was you.
Or it is possible he does recognize him, but is still angry with him from his birthday. Or he also could be terrified of the literal purple man. We don't know, but what we do know is that his behavior changes in 4 years in the original Five Nights at Freddy's. Using the logbook as a guide and removing the concept of Casty from it, the logbook reveals that communication was happening between the brothers at the time. Communication in which Golden Freddy was constantly asking questions to recognize not only who Michael was, but what were his thoughts and memories. And after the brothers finally had their correspondence, whether Michael knew it was him or not, I believe Bite Victim does in fact forgive his brother after seeing what has happened to him. One of the questions the crying child asks Mike, "What do you see?" with a graphic of a window in the logbook, it may very well be Bite Victim making sure that how he sees Michael is correct. A zombified corpse that was a facsimile of the brother he once knew. And once he realizes the pain he has gone through, to me it is unbelievable that he would harm Mike now, especially after learning he had done all of this because of what he did to him in FNAF 4, that he was trying to make amends. After all, Golden Freddy makes no appearance in FNAF 3. For that point in life, not only has Michael come to grips with his sin, but Golden Freddy has already forgiven Michael, so there's no reason to interfere. The fact that in every game where we play as Michael, Golden Freddy is present in some way, even having stand-ins with Nightmare Fredbear in FNAF 4 and Yendo in Sister Location, crescendoed in FFPS since Golden Freddy has no stand-in or presence, Michael was truly ready to die and be reunited with his brother. But despite Michael being forgiven by his brother, his forgiveness also stoked a different emotion entirely. In UCN, I believe Bite Victim keeps William alive in anger to show just the amount of pain his father inflicted onto others. Keep in mind, in FNAF 4, Bite Victim is not scared of the animatronic characters, only the Springlock suits. When asked, quote, "Do you remember what you saw," unquote, by his Fredbear plush and knowing who his father is, in the 96 ending of FNAF 4, the lines, quote, "We are still here, we are still your friends," unquote, showcases he had an attachment far beyond imaginary friends to the animatronic characters. It is echoed when he is united with the other spirits who had managed to live on and who all share the common interest in reclaiming their happiest day that was stolen from them.
"We know who our friends are, and you are not one of them."
Recall back the scene in which Golden Freddy's spirit pushes William into putting on the Springtrap suit in FNAF 3. In this scene, Bite Victim literally overcomes his fear by literally pushing his abusive father back into those suits that used to terrify him so much. He does this to get revenge not only for his friends, but for himself, Michael, and Elizabeth. At that point, he already wished to see his father suffer. The title is associated with Golden Freddy the most in UCN, the one you should not have killed. This is usually used as a catalyst to discredit the crying child as being Golden Freddy, but I like to view it as referencing how Bite Victim truly blames William for his death. William's actions always lead to consequences, but what makes him so evil is that usually the ramifications for his actions are tolls that he does not have to take on. Instead, his children, or his close associates, are unknowingly taking the bullet for him. William, by being an abusive and negligent father who practices scummy business practice, murdered children, and destroyed so many families, he inadvertently set up the dominoes that would end up killing his own children. Similar to how Elizabeth died from the Fun Times. While the vehicle in which how they died differ, the machines were built by the same madman who was truly the one responsible for their deaths.
He tried to release you. He tried to release us. But I'm not gonna let that happen. I will hold you here. I will keep you here. No matter how many times they burn us.
Michael had successfully made sure that everyone could find peace. Even Charlie gave the crying child the party he never had. She gave him his happiest day. But that still couldn't make him rest. He wanted to make sure that William suffered the same way that all of his victims did. Which is why Old Man Consequences tried to warn him about his lust for revenge being a farcical. It would never bring him satisfaction. The same way killing innocents never gave his own father satisfaction. As strange it is to hear, there is no peace in violence. And with that, I believe today's episode is over. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to stay updated, please consider subscribing, following, or sharing this podcast. It surely helps us broaden our reach. And also consider following us on our Twitter at FazbearPodcast or supporting us on our Buy Me a Coffee page using the link in the description below. Next episode is entirely up to you all again. That's right, we are doing another poll! Our last poll took us in a direction of including the Apton family arc, but now that we're done with that, I want to hear what you would all like to explore next. Would you like me to continue our story's trajectory and move to the next game in the timeline if that VR help wanted and secure a breach later down the line? Or we could venture into the books for Fazbear Fights for a spell. There are some really good stories in there with a lot of lore and characters. Speaking of which, characters. Perhaps a few episodes doing a deep dive analysis of the various phases of the franchises, their story symbolism. That could be really fun. In the description of this episode, you will find a link to our Twitter where you can vote on our poll. And if you want to vote on books or characters, let me know which ones you want me to hit first. With all that out of the way, thank you all again for listening and taking this journey through Scott's original work of the franchise with us. Once again, I have been your host, Nick, and thank you for listening. Have a good night.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.